In light of what I have said about the role of religion, again, I speak about the Jewish and Christian religion here, and its promotion of alternate systems of governance, law, tradition, the allegiance that the Jewish and Christian people had over and above the state, even while it was respectful of the legitimate authority of the state, but always seeing the state as subservient to a higher natural law, to God himself. Let me address the question of the church's role in history with the state. Popular history has it that Constantine changed all of this notion of Christianity's suspicion of the state by establishing Christianity as the official religion of the Roman Empire. Now, we simply don't have the time to enter into the entire history of this period, but let me just say this. In the period where Constantine embraces the church and legalizes Christianity and even establishes it as a state religion, in this period of time, Christians were being horribly persecuted. And the most notable aspect of Constantine's law was a new toleration of Christianity. He and his successors, I would say, went too far in taking the liberty of the church and transforming it into making the church an official institution of the state. The use of public resources in this regard, I think, was in the building of churches, for example, was, I think, a serious mistake for the independence of the church. But when one looks at this history, we need to be very careful to distinguish between the unjust practices that even continue to the present day and the roots that we would have to identify as leading to the concept of freedom. It was Christianity itself, not atheism, not secularism or materialism, that first advanced the idea that the state and the church should be separate. It was the church that put that notion on the table first. The concept that institutions could flourish in the absence of civic approval is what led to the creation of the university, of the monastery, the hospital, the rule of law in courts, the flourishing of science, and institutional and international charity. I'll talk about that a little bit later. Now, what about the claim that the age of faith was really the Dark Ages, and that it took the Enlightenment to bring light to the Dark Ages? It's very interesting that historians today are discovering that this line of thought is little more than an 18th and 19th century relic of wishful thinking. The so-called Dark Ages saw the origins of the watermill, of the windmill for capitalist production. Monastic estates were used for the domestication and production of cloth and fish production. They were the first modern institutions of complex capitalist production. And it was during this period of time that we saw the development of clocks, eyeglasses, chimneys, and many other forms of indoor temperature control. Likewise, transportation advanced dramatically. It was the same in the world of art and literature. Music, painting, architecture, and writing flourished under Christendom as it never had under the Roman Empire. And it was the case with science as well. Copernicus's heliocentric model was not the beginning, but the culmination of a scientific advance that stretched back centuries to the followers of St. Thomas Aquinas. There were numerous 14th century thinkers that may not be household names, but it was their scientific investigations that led to the explosion of progress two centuries later. Now, I have written on the subject of the discovery of economics in Spain in the 16th, 15th, and 16th centuries. Let me just allude to that. The late scholastics gave us the first coherent theories of the origin of values and price. They theorized about inflation and the business cycle. And in a complete break from ancient world bigotry, they saw the merchant as someone who lives out a high calling and benefits society at large. I would recommend for your reading the book by Rodney Stark, The Victory of Reason, which delineates all that I have just given you in great detail and gives a lot of references that you would find useful for your own study. Indeed, it was Christianity that gave us the body ideas that today we know as classical liberalism, which can be summed up in four central claims. One, that all people have rights that come by nature and cannot be abrogated. Two, society flourishes most when the state does the least. Third, economic advance is desirable and made possible through free exchange, free enterprise. And fourth, the social peace is best maintained when religion and the state are separated. Any informed observer will note that the old liberal tradition was not always friendly to Christianity. I speak from an American perspective here because many of the American founders were deists, not Orthodox Christians. I think of Thomas Paine or Thomas Jefferson. In fact, many of the American founders did not embrace the idea of a creed. This is true enough. But just consider that they were reacting to several centuries of history in which the state and the church had become bound up with one another, where the monarch was claimed to be the head of the state, the church in England. The governmental system of monarchism led them to believe that liberty is threatened by such kings as by the religion that the king professed. But they made a mistake in their analysis, that the tyrant professed Christianity was an incidental fact. He was merely using the culturally dominant religion as a cover for his ambition. Atheistic liberals will freely cite the religious skepticism of the old liberal school, but they overlook contrary facts. American ministers were the first and leading champions of the American Revolution. They cited Locke, for example, from their pulpits and spoke of human rights, religious liberty, and the need for progress. And then there remains the issue of the institutional church. To what extent is this institution a bulwark in defense of liberty or a source for curbing human liberty? Without the church, the overarching weight of cultural authority falls to only two sources, the state and the individual. The individual is not often in a position to exercise influence necessary to fight bad policies or defend liberty. The organized church, on the other hand, is much better suited, which is why, for example, the church played such an important role in the overthrow of communism in Eastern Europe and continues to play a critical role in Latin America, fighting attempts of would-be despots to grab social and economic power. We can see this role and confusions regarding it more clearly by examining the pontificate of Pope Benedict XVI. Just when he began his pontificate, there were many commentators who said that he was a conservative or an ultra-conservative, a person who would infringe the liberty of Catholics and certainly not contribute to liberty in the world. And this impression has gained quite a bit of currency from his time as the head of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. There it was his responsibility to curtail dissenting theologians, and many would say that he was someone who was willing to use forceful methods to force the truth on people. He was the very epitome of the inquisitor. But few observers are willing to recognize that his actions during the period that he was head of the Congregation of the doctrine of the faith did not amount to coercion of any sort. Theologians who purport to teach the Catholic faith, but who instead publish and teach in profound dissent from or undermine that faith, are themselves engaged in a form of deception. Censuring them does not deny them their right to teach and publish. It only revokes the privilege of teaching in the name of the Catholic faith. They are still free to write and to publish, and even to write and publish as Catholics in any venue that they choose. The act of revoking a certain teaching mandate at Catholic universities, then, is not an illiberal action, any more than it would be for an auto company to dismiss an automobile salesman who sold his customers cars that are a different make and model as advertised. If an Audi salesman sold Fiats, he would be breaking the contractual arrangements that he has. This denies no one their fundamental rights. It merely classifies the terms of a contractual arrangement, so to speak, making it more honest, more above board. Consider that those disciplined by the then Cardinal Ratzinger were teaching things like liberation theology and moral concepts completely opposed to Catholic tradition, and had long publishing records behind them. The cardinal's actions were wholly justifiable and not illiberal in any sense. So on these grounds, then, there is no basis for describing Benedict XVI as an ultra-conservative. And permit me to carry my argument one step further. Having looked at his writings over many years, I have observed one consistent theme, namely a firm and unyielding attachment to the idea of religious liberty and the power of Christ to convert hearts in the absence of coercion. Unlike many in the traditionalist camp, Cardinal Ratzinger showed no sympathy for the notion of temporal power, which amounts to the claim that the Church should exercise state-like powers. Instead, Ratzinger had written in favor of the Church as a cultural force whose truth claims wield influence only over hearts and minds. In this regard, Cardinal Ratzinger is very much in line with the Second Vatican Council, in which he played an important role, which speaks of the desire of the Church to propose rather than impose its teaching upon the human heart. What this attachment to human liberty signifies is hugely important for the history of modern Catholicism. To the mid to late 19th century, at a time when democracy was rising and papal states were under serious strain, and when radical political movements were on the move, two general camps emerged within the Catholic Church. The Ultramontanist camp, which was one that favored temporal power and regarded the idea of religious liberty as a fateful surrender to secularism and modernism. And on the other side were the liberals, who embraced religious liberty and argued that papal infallibility should be embraced only in strictly defined terms related to its own competency, namely faith and morals, but not to politics and economics and the like. Liberals and ultramontanists were found in every country on the continent and in England, and the debate split between these two groups for decades. These issues were debated in great detail at the First Vatican Council. Though Pius IX tended to favor the ultramontanist side, the final result of the council was compatible with a certain version of the Catholic liberal position, as is seen in the acquiescence to the definition by a number of prominent persons who initially sought to modify or restrict or deflect it, such as the American Isaac Hecker, the British John Henry Cardinal Newman, and Lord Acton, among others. As eventually defined, the Pope's infallibility would extend to faith and morals, but not to politics and other matters, as some of the ultramontanists had hoped. Even Pius IX's Syllabus of Errors could be read as compatible with an embrace of liberty if one sees that while it condemned the view that the Church must be universally separated from the state, it tolerated the view that the Church can be made prudently and advantageously distinct from the state. And yet this debate persisted well into the 20th century. I would like to cite an extended quote from the Second Vatican Council because I think it goes to the question of the view of religion toward the individual conscience. This comes from the section of the Second Vatican Council entitled Dignitatis Humanae from the second section. I quote, "This Vatican Council declares that the human person has a right to religious freedom. This freedom means that all men are to be immune from coercion on the part of individuals or social groups and of any human power in such wise that no one is to be forced to act in a manner contrary to his own beliefs, whether privately or publicly, whether alone or in association with others, within due limits. This council further declares that the right to religious freedom has its foundation in the very dignity of the human person, as this dignity is known through the revealed word of God and by reason itself. This right of the human person to religious freedom is to be recognized in the constitutional law whereby society is governed, and thus it is to become a civil right. It is in accordance with their dignity that persons, as persons, that is, beings endowed with reason and free will and therefore privileged to bear personal responsibility, that all men should be at once impelled by nature and also bound by a moral obligation to seek the truth, especially religious truth. They are also bound to adhere to the truth once it is known and to order their whole lives in accordance with the demands of truth. However, men cannot discharge these obligations in a manner in keeping with their own nature unless they enjoy immunity from external coercion as well as psychological freedom. Therefore, the right to religious freedom has its foundation not just in the subjective disposition of the person, but in his very nature. In consequence, the right to this immunity continues to exist even in those who do not live up to their obligation in seeking the truth, and adhering to it and the exercise of this right is not to be impeded, provided the just public order be preserved." Close quote. This is an immensely powerful insight and was issued at a time that caused great consternation among the hyper-traditionalists, the modern ultramontanists at the Second Vatican Council. After the Second Vatican Council, a new kind of liberalism emerged within Catholicism that claimed to have patrimony in the old liberal worldview, but was actually a departure from authentic old liberalism, which never doubted the core truths of the faith. I'm referring to the new liberalism that descends from the core of Catholic competency and the magisterium's prerogative to teach in the name of the faith. This is different from the old liberalism, which embraced freedom and truth, and in fact saw freedom as the best means to seek and advance the truth. This was the same with Catholicism in the time and in the style of Antonio Rosmini, Cardinal John Henry Newman, Lord Acton, and their generation. This new liberalism, in contrast, wants to argue not about religious liberty, but about moral liberty of belief itself. It embraced not democracy as such, but democratic relativism that resented any truth claim, a kind of moral relativism. It thus brought into question core truth claims about doctrine and faith. Benedict, I want to be clear, and as is manifestly obvious, is decidedly not this sort of new liberal. In fact, we have a good reason to reclaim the word on behalf of its authentic meaning: religious truth united with political and economic liberty. I believe insofar as the modern papacy has implications for economics and politics, it is in the direction of a humane and unifying liberalism that places its hope in society, faith, and freedom. Consider even the name Benedict. When it was announced that Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger would take the name of Benedict XVI, the question immediately presented itself, well, who is Benedict XV? What does it imply for the future of this papacy? Pope Benedict XV was pope from 1914 to 1922. The Pope, who witnessed an age of peace and prosperity and hope, turned into bloodshed, violence, and the total state. He is remembered mostly for his anguished encyclical, Beatissimi Apostolorum, which sought to end the conflicts and battles that became what we now know as World War I, the war which so violently dashed the hopes of many generations of 19th century classical liberals. The temporal power of the papal state had come to an end, and at the urging of the liberal wing of the faith, that happened. They had placed their hope in the capacity of Christian faith to flourish in the absence of coercion, and in the capacity of the world to continue its progress toward peace and prosperity. In 1914, Pope Benedict XV warned of the great dangers ahead in an illiberal world. He observed what he called the dread phantom of wars hold sway over the minds of men. The combatants are the greatest and wealthiest nations of the earth, he said. What wonder then if, well provided with the most awful weapons modern military science has devised, they strive to destroy one another with refinements of horror. Benedict XV drew particular attention to the human and economic costs of an illiberal world. Obviously, the sad words that Benedict wrote foreshadowed what would follow: crimes and terrors of communism and Nazism, an end to European unity, the advent of weapons of mass destruction, and the takeover of the West by ideologies of social management, secularism, consumerism, and every other kind of horror. These were the worldly concerns of popes that followed Benedict XV, all the way up to John Paul the Great, who was singularly instrumental in overthrowing the great tyrannies of the last century. It was a debilitating time for anyone who believed in the spirit of Lord Acton and his contemporaries. So what we see is that the Church, in its doctrine and in the teaching and in its institutions, really can be compatible with an authentic understanding of old liberalism. What I'd like to do next is to compare some of the themes and ideas and sum up some of what we've talked about.